contributors like Polina Vasiliev, Don DeBar, and our producer, Ziri Rideau. Coming up next is Feminist Magazine. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow at 6 p.m., and I'll be back with you next Wednesday at 6 p.m., and I hope you will join us again. For KPFK, I'm West Siegmiller.
The program that you're about to hear is a rebroadcast and has previously aired here on KPFK.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Many of us are familiar with the Jane Collective, or Jane, an underground group of radical feminist activists in Chicago who were part of the Chicago Women's Liberation Union that operated there from 1969 to 1973, secretly providing safe and affordable abortions to women when abortion was illegal. But few people, including myself, knew that there were radical feminists right here in Oakland in the 1970s through the 2000s who were also practicing this kind of self-help reproductive care and who were teaching women how to do their own self-care.
Gonna keep on singing loudly. Keep on singing loudly.
It's really an incredible story of movement history, a lot of which I didn't know, even as somebody who was involved in a lot of it, and a lot of which has kind of been lost. So you've really unearthed some very deep and exciting and sobering and challenging stuff. The publisher of the book is AK Press, and their website describes Deep Care as, quote, the story of the radical feminists who worked outside the law to defend abortion. So most people reading that would assume that the bulk of the story takes place before 1973, when Roe versus Wade established, temporarily, as it turned out, the right to abortion throughout the United States. But in fact, most of the events that you chronicle took place between the mid-1970s and the mid-1990s, so well after abortion became legal and somewhat accessible, quite accessible here in California, but not so much in many other places. So who were these radical activists? What were they doing? And why did they need to be working outside the law to defend abortion rights during that period?
Well, to start, they were ordinary people. Some were lay people who got trained in how to provide gynecological and abortion care at a specific licensed clinic in Oakland, Women's Choice Clinic, which was part of a network of licensed feminist women's health centers that were started in the 1970s. And so a big part of my book is the story of this one independent clinic. And some of the activists were lay people who learned and practiced gynecology and abortion outside the walls of the clinic, like in living rooms and bedrooms. And these people called their practice self-help. So in what were called self-help groups, people learned how to do things like identify a yeast infection or a possible sexually transmitted infection. And they learned how to track their cycles and their fertility. They learned how to do things like perform a pelvic exam and size the uterus. And critically, they also learned how to perform abortions. So what they used to perform these abortions was a simple suction device that they put together themselves, made out of equipment like a cannula, tubing, a syringe, a mason jar, and they became proficient in performing these early manual suction abortions for each other and for people in their community. And they called the procedure menstrual extraction. To get good at it, they would meet regularly, like every week or every 2 weeks, to practice sectioning out the contents of their non-pregnant uteruses. And once again, they called this underground lay healthcare movement self-help. So I realize right now that some people might be thinking, like, wait, what? And that makes sense because most people don't know that there was an abortion self-help movement and that there was an underground during years that Roe stood. But during those years, activists did teach and practice simple suction abortion outside of clinics. And then in the 1980s, some activists started focusing their efforts on defending patients against anti-abortion extremists, or antis, as they called them, at clinic doors. And after the federal government made it a crime to block someone from accessing a clinic entrance through the FACE Act, or Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act in 1994, some of those activists kind of refocused themselves on refining their clinic escorting techniques and started developing new clinic escorting programs. So that's a little bit about who these activists were. And I want to just kind of circle back for a moment to your question about why they needed to work outside the law. For a long time, abortion was legal nationwide, but not necessarily accessible. And as the people who participated in my book, who I interviewed, argued, we can't rely on the state necessarily, or capitalism for that matter, to take care of us. And because they really believed this, self-helpers felt strongly that they needed to work outside of the law. So I'll just give you a bit more context. In 1977, Congress passed what was called the Hyde Amendment. And under the Hyde Amendment, the federal government was no longer able to fund abortion for people on Medicaid, so low-income people. So while abortion was constitutionally protected, to access it, you had to have good insurance and also the resources to get yourself to a clinic. And in the decades since the passage of the Hyde Amendment, we've seen, you know, basically the systematic dismantling of abortion access by the right, in part through like forced closure of clinics all around the country. You know, for many activists, the 1989 Supreme Court decision called Webster versus Reproductive Health Services marked like the beginning of the end of Roe. So in that case, in Webster, the Supreme Court said that like ideas about trimesters and viability were not in the Constitution, and that there was really no reason that the government shouldn't have an interest in protecting, quote, potential human life throughout pregnancy. And that made it possible, that ruling made it possible for individual states to start restricting abortion. And this was the moment, 1989, when underground self-help groups in the Bay Area really started to shift into high gear. They expanded their network and really started to, I would say, skill up. They believed that Roe would go down, and they were very radical in their politics. And some of them told me that they wanted to be ready for the revolution. And they really believed that community-based solutions were essential. You know, for some other self-helpers, working outside the law wasn't so much practical as it was philosophical. So for these self-helpers, the fundamental idea behind abortion self-help was that, you know, abortion is normal and abortion is natural, and that small groups of lay people who are trained in sterile technique and in manual vacuum aspiration can easily do it. So for self-helpers, saying we can do this ourselves was about like saying no to the governments and the medical industries, like administering and surveillance of a process that they believed was very much intimately their own. There was a menstrual extraction conference that Women's Choice Clinic actually hosted in 1974 in San Francisco. And at that conference, self-helpers argued that institutionalized medicine was a means of social control. And they had themselves experienced misogyny and neglect and abuse by doctors and by the system, especially the women of color had experienced those things. And so they deeply distrusted the medical industry. What self-helpers wanted to do starting in the early 1970s was really deinstitutionalize abortion and redistribute what Lindsay Comey, the longtime director of Women's Choice, called the restricted knowledge of gynecology. I would say that like the reasons for doing underground abortion work evolved continually in the 1980s, when Christian right groups like Operation Rescue really escalated their harassment and terrorization of women seeking abortions at clinics by, you know, deploying throngs of people to blockade clinic doors and basically scare patients away. When abortion is legal, but you can't get to it and through the clinic doors to access it, then that legal right is largely symbolic. So self-helpers and clinic defenders really understood this threat of the right. They saw who their enemy was and what the anti-abortion movement was fundamentally all about. And they really put their bodies on the line in the name of body sovereignty.
Wow. There's a lot there to unpack, and we are going to try and unpack it. I'm going to come back to some of what you were saying about clinic defense and the assault by the right wing, which you record in a way that's really thrilling as well as really sobering. But I just want to come back to this idea about self-help and ask, how did you become aware of this movement? Because not that many people really know about the activities that you were just describing in that period.
Well, I didn't set out to write a book about abortion, self-help, and clinic defense. I had been writing a book about feminists and queer poets who were also health activists, poets like Audre Lorde and Judy Gronn and Pat Parker and some others. And in my mind, it was an academic book largely about poetry. It was, and it is compelling to me that these poets wrote about how their material environments and their cultural environments had made them sick, and how they wanted to imagine what feminist medicine and healing could look like. And so in the process of this research, I learned that Pat Parker, who was a Black lesbian feminist revolutionary and poet who passed away in 1989 from breast cancer, I learned that Pat Parker had worked at Women's Choice Clinic for a decade. And so I started researching the clinic, and I learned that it was part of a network of feminist women's health centers and abortion clinics that had grown out of a West Coast-led gynecological self-help movement. And I thought, this is so interesting and amazing. And I started to see that this was a really critical history and one that largely had not been told. And so I went on to make studying this history the center of my life for the next 5+ years. I started doing oral histories with people who'd worked at the clinic, and I thought, okay, maybe I could write like a historical article about the clinic. I didn't realize that I was uncovering a decades-long movement history that was about the clinic, but that was also about an abortion underground and a clinic defense coalition. And so I went on to interview dozens more activists, clinic workers and underground lay health workers and clinic defenders, and some of the people I interviewed many times over years. And there were stretches of time when, like, not a single day went by that I wasn't in conversation with someone for this book. It just completely took over my life. And so one of the stories that I tell in the book is the story of encountering what I think of as bedroom closet archives. So to write a book about the abortion self-help movement, I had to follow people into their bedrooms and help them pull boxes of movement records and ephemera down from top shelves. That's how intimate the research sometimes was.
One of the things that Deep Care memorializes is a kind of twisting labyrinth of connections between reproductive justice, queer liberation, feminist economics, anti-imperialist activism, and even feminist publishing. And as I read the book, it occurred to me that it kind of embodies an intersectionality, which today we hear a lot of that word, but I'm not sure that it's so well understood what it really means. And, you know, I think that's an aspect of the later second wave of feminism that's kind of been lost. You read books about the women's movement, and it's got like a chapter on reproductive rights and abortion care mm-hmm. over here, and a chapter on cultural work over there, and on feminist economics enterprise over here. And it doesn't layer those things together in the way that your book does. Is that one of the things that you're trying to bring to light with this book?
Oh, Kate, thank you so much for that read on the book. That was a really generous read, and it just makes me so happy, you know, that you're kind of detecting the ways that I was trying to kind of layer these different aspects of movement work. You know, the kind of materiality of abortion work wasn't separate from you know, reading manuscripts and producing volumes of poetry. You know, feminist publishing and feminist healthcare were entangled with each other, especially in the 1970s, when a lot of feminists were deeply involved with institution building projects. And yes, absolutely. I wanted to show how radical feminism has always been intersectional. I'll just say a few things about these terms because I think about them a lot. I think when most people think of intersectionality today, they are talking about identity politics. And in a mainstream kind of popular cultural sense, identity politics is the idea that your lived experience of identity reveals social and political truths, which is true. But on the left, some critics of this version of identity politics say that maintaining a focus on individual or even group experiences of identity can undermine efforts to build a unified front of resistance across identities. Also, because identity politics can be so focused on uplifting like individual testimonies about the impacts of oppression, it can preclude or prevent like an analysis of or even like obscure or hide the structural root causes of oppression. That's how the critique goes. And I think it's a compelling critique and I largely subscribe to it. But I think what many people don't know is that intersectionality theory grows out of the insights of 1970s Black feminism. And many of these Black feminists, feminists like Barbara Smith from the Combahee River Collective, they were socialists with a really deep structural analysis of race class oppression. So the Combahee River Collective in 1977 published their like very canonical now Black feminist statement. And in it, they said famously, if Black women were free, it would mean that everyone else would have to be free since our freedom requires the destruction of all systems of oppression. So what they're getting at here is that Black women's experience, how Black women experience multiple oppressions like racism, sexism, sometimes homophobia too, among others, racism, sexism, and homophobia together produce an experience of oppression that is more complicated than just the sum of the three. And like this is what in the late 1980s, a decade later, Kimberly Crenshaw formally named the quote, intersectional experience. And she based her claim on legal research that she had done about workplace discrimination. But her findings basically reiterated the claim of the 1970s Black radical feminists. Recently, Barbara Smith had an interview with Kianga Yamada Taylor about how it was never Combahee's intention to suggest that people should only talk to or organize with other people who share their identity. Rather, identity for Combahee was like a position or a reference point, not an end in itself. So perhaps it's not a surprise that these 1970s radical Black feminists were involved in early gynecological and abortion self-help, along with holistic Black women's self-help. The course these feminists set for Black feminism is really inextricable from the course that they helped set for radical reproductive freedom and justice activism. So, okay, so just to bring it back to the labyrinth of connections that you mentioned, reproductive justice and feminist economics and feminist publishing and queer and trans liberation and anti-imperialism, these are all struggles for improved material conditions for women and other gender minorities, in particular women of color. And they're struggles to get basic material needs met, like, you know, access to healthcare or a wage or education or safety or freedom to just move and live your life as you want to. And this is, I think, what feminism is all about. What, like, at its most radical, it's always been about helping people to meet material needs, both each other's and their own.
So you're saying, especially women of color, a lot, and that might give the impression that most of the work done in and by the Oakland Feminist Women's Health Center, which later became the West Coast Feminist Health Project, and Women's Choice Clinic was done by women of color. But I don't know that that's what you're saying. So can you just sort of talk about what this intersectionality looked like in the context of Women's Choice, Oakland Feminist Women's Health Center, and West Coast Women's Health Project?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The self-help and clinic defense movements themselves were diverse. They were politically diverse. They were diverse in terms of race and class. They were, you know, gender diverse in terms of just how people lived and expressed their genders, right? the movements themselves were largely working class led, starting in the 1970s, at the very beginning of the movement. The health work that health workers did in a clinic setting was often work that was done by working class women of color, many of whom were also parenting. Of the kind of different arms of the abortion self-help movement, the clinic was probably the most racially diverse space. In terms of clinic defense, that movement attracted a lot of young people, and they were coming from different experiences of race and class, and they had really diverse politics. And then the self-help groups, the underground gynecological and abortion self-help groups, were largely made up of white women, at least on the accounts that self-helpers shared with me, both working and middle class. And many of them were anarchist identified. I don't know if this tells the whole story about who was doing self-help, but this is the account that the people I interviewed gave me of the underground self-help movement in the Bay Area.
One of the things I learned from your book was that certain things that I knew about but didn't realize were connected actually all sort of came from the same bunch of people. And one of those was Diana Publishing, or Diana Press, I think it was called, which was a feminist press, which actually operated out of the same space as Women's Choice. Did I remember that correctly?
Well, they had separate offices, but for a period of time in the mid-1970s, these two projects, on the one hand, the Independent Lesbian Feminist Publishing Initiative and the Independent Abortion Clinic, were essentially the same organization. They were sharing assets. They were sharing staff. You know, women would work at the press during the day and learn about printing and binding. And then in the after hours, they would go over and work abortion clinics at Women's Choice to sort of subsidize their income. The 1970s feminists were extremely savvy about how to bring their various projects together. So in 1976, the Oakland Feminist Women's Health Center joined up with a couple of other feminist businesses to create what they called a Feminist Economic Network Corporation, or FEN. I remember when I first learned about this, it just sort of blew my mind. They collaborated with Diana Press, Kalita Reed and Casey Zarnick, and also Joanne Parent and Valerie Angers of the Feminist Federal Credit Union in Detroit. And they actually bought a building. Not just any building. This was in Detroit, a historic six-story building called Women's City Club in downtown Detroit on Park Avenue. And they called it the Feminist Women's City Club. And that was going to be their headquarters. And so for a period of time in 1976, some of the feminists who had been doing these institution building projects in Oakland went to Detroit to work on the building and to build up the Feminist Economic Network. They invited feminist businesses to occupy storefront space on the first floor. And crucially, they also taught and learned self-help in the building. So one feminist named Kalita Reed, who was a co-editor at Diana Press, explained to me that the first time she learned about menstrual extraction was at the Detroit building of the Feminist Economic Network.
You know, I was really surprised to learn this history, partly because it's just something that is kind of unthinkable now. I think both politically and organizationally, a women's clinic would be funded by nonprofits and foundations that would look at something like FEN or something like Diana Press and say, this is mission creep. You have to be non-political, or you can't be doing for profit on one side and self-help on another. Like, these things have to be separated. And then the other thing is that in the world that I came up in, there's deep suspicion of anything that reeks of capitalism or entrepreneurship, I guess. It's not that that wasn't there at the time that you're talking about, but that people were willing to kind of get dirty with realities of people needing to make money and people maybe not being able to afford to do everything for free. You know, there's sort of a little split sometimes between the like social justice nonprofits and the more grassroots movement. But at this time, it seems like it all kind of flowed together in a way that was both amazing and organic and vibrant, and also deeply messy and at times even devastatingly destructive.
I mean, I think that's an excellent description of what it was like. I think there was so much optimism in the 1970s among these feminists about building their own institutions, right? And they really envisioned a feminist economy that was autonomous and sustainable and that could free them from patriarchy. And it was also very controversial even at the time. You know, within months of their arrival in Detroit and the establishment of the Feminist Economic Network at the Detroit building, people started to come after them and alleged that they were trying to build a feminist empire and that they were capitalists and therefore necessarily anti-feminist. And ultimately, FEN did not survive within months of its establishment. Basically, they did not have the revenues to pay the mortgage and remain in the building because they just didn't have sort of a critical mass of local support by the women's movement. But I really think that the Feminist Economic Network took the principles of self-help in a way and kind of ran with them. It was totally imperfect, but they really tried to center skill sharing and relationship building and like taking advantage of existing structures, you know, whether that be the clinic or the corporation, to, you know, improve how people live. The whole controversy around the Feminist Economic Network in Detroit, like, just lays bare, you know, these questions that divided the women's movement and that also just continue to divide the left, right? Like, is horizontal organizing necessarily radical, let alone always feasible? You know, what are the limitations of affinity group work? You know, what do we mean when we talk about democracy and what are the values that we're actually upholding when we do that? Is it possible to work through an oppressive structure like capitalism while also advocating for the abolition of capitalism, right? And so these were the types of like really big picture questions that these feminists in the 1970s were digging deep into. And, you know, I have a tremendous amount of respect for them for doing that.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Kate Raphael's interview with Angela Hume about her new book called Deep Care, The Radical Activist Who Provided Abortions, Defied the Law, and Fought to Keep Clinics Open.
Can we keep on singing loudly? Keep on singing loudly. Keep on singing loudly.
The Pacifica National Board and the delegates of the five Pacifica stations serving on the local station boards are considering an amendment to the bylaws of the foundation that would change the manner of filling vacancies if a delegate position becomes open in the middle of a term. The language of the amendment and more information about the bylaws amendment process can be found on the Pacifica.org website. KPFK's delegates will be voting on the amendment at a public meeting of the KPFK Local Station Board conducted via Zoom on Sunday, July 14th at 10:30 a.m. Information about the meetings can be found at kpftx.org on the calendar of Pacifica meetings. There's a half hour of public comment at all local station board meetings. You can communicate with the Pacifica National Board or the local station board via email. Their email addresses are pnb@pacifica.org and lsb@kpfk.org, respectively.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Kate Raphael's interview with Angela Hume about her new book called Deep Care, The Radical Activist Who Provided Abortions, Defied the Law, and Fought to Keep Clinics Open.
Can we keep on singing loudly? Keep on singing loudly.
The clinic defense movement that you've referred to came out of an era of terrorism in the 1980s that I think has also been widely forgotten. You know, it's a given now. If you go to any facility that performs abortions openly, you're going to see an armed guard. That was not always the case. Talk about the climate of fear that developed around abortion providers in the 1980s. Where did it start and how did it change the lives of the people that you interviewed?
Yes, as you said, clinic defense developed out of an era of anti-abortion harassment and terrorism that started in the 1980s. And this terrorism intensified in the 1990s. So just to kind of give a little bit of context, what had happened was that the new right that elected Reagan in 1981 had worked throughout the 1970s to fold free market conservatives together with white Christians into a single base. And by the 1980s, the Republican anti-welfare campaign had come to imply an anti-abortion stance. And this, I think, is exemplified by the passage of the Hyde Amendment, which once again prohibited federal Medicaid funding for abortion. So the abortion issue becomes the linchpin of the right strategy to consolidate its base. And this strategy was very effective in terms of amassing a very large base. Operation Rescue, an anti-abortion militant organization, came on the scene in 1986. And Operation Rescue was founded by an evangelical Christian named Randall Terry. And what they did was galvanize their membership base to descend en masse upon abortion clinics to blockade them and shut them down. So just to give you a sense of what this looked like, kind of at its most extreme, in the summer of 1991 in Wichita, Kansas, Operation Rescue recruited 25,000 people over 6 weeks to the city of Wichita to shut down abortion clinics. In the San Francisco Bay Area, clinic defenders came together to address the need, first of all, for clinic defense, and to form a coalition. And they called their coalition the Bay Area Coalition Against Operation Rescue. And its purpose was to stop the clinic blockades, which had started to come to the Bay Area. Sometimes clinic defenders would face off with hundreds of operation members at clinic doors. And this happened in the late 80s into the early 1990s. And then in 1994, the federal government passed the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, or the FACE Act. And the reason they did this was because things had gotten really bad for abortion seekers and abortion workers. In the first half of 1994, to give you a sense of this, more than half of U.S. abortion clinics had received death threats. They were experiencing stalking, bombings, invasions, arsons, and then the blockades. So by the end of 1994, there had been 4 murders and 8 attempted murders of abortion workers. So the FACE Act made it a federal crime to block a clinic's entrance. And also around that time, the feds intervened by putting cops, local police and federal marshals and FBI agents in and around clinics. And this required health workers to cooperate with them. And Lindsay Comey told me about like hate mail that the clinic would receive. You know, she would be on the job and asking herself if like today was the day that she was going to have to climb out the fire ladder. Or she would wonder whether she should be wearing a bulletproof vest. According to Lindsay, it was life under occupation. Those are her words. And the war was at your door.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that because I found that statement quite provocative. You know, I've spent time in Palestine. And of course, right now, Palestine is very heavy on my mind. And when I read that quote from Lindsay, I thought, is that a fair use of the word occupation? Like, does any white woman in the United States have a right to use that word to describe any part of our situation? But you use it and Lindsay uses it. Why do you feel like it's the right word for the experiences that you're describing?
Is occupation the right word to use when talking about what abortion providers and seekers went through in the 1990s? That's such a good question. I don't know what it is the word that a lifelong militant abortion provider and Navy veteran used to describe her community's experience of both providing and accessing care in the face of anti-abortion terrorism and state interference and surveillance. Abortion workers were arguably engaged in what we might call a two-way fight. So they were facing off with the militant anti-abortion Christian right, and also arguably our, quote, liberal democracy. And I want to put scare quotes around liberal democracy, because liberal democracy's solution to the problem of domestic terrorism against abortion providers was to put federal cops in clinics. So in short, to police them. Now, I have no personal lived experience of occupation, so I just want to comment briefly and then let listeners, you know, read the abortion defenders' accounts in the book about what Lindsay calls the warriors and really decide for themselves what they think about the use of this term occupation.
So I want to ask one more question about Bakor and the countering the right wing, and then transition to talk a little about the current moment and how the events that you describe in your book relate to what we're seeing now, as, you know, Roe has been overturned and there are quite a few states in which abortion is not available at all, and quite a few more in which it's scarcely available or heavily curtailed. One of the things about the use of the word occupation that impressed me and sort of made me really think is that when you're talking about the warriors, as you say, the movement to defend abortion clinics was very much entwined with the anti-imperialist movement in the Bay Area, and specifically a group called Roots Against War. So I want you to talk a little about what Roots Against War was and how they became involved in defending abortion clinics. And sort of more generally, you say that Bakor was a leading anti-fascist movement of their generation. So talk about how Bakor fought fascism.
I mean, I want to say that, in fact, it was not only clinic defense, but abortion self-help, too. Promoted an anti-imperialist politics from the beginning. You know, just as the abortion self-help movement was getting on its feet in the very early 1970s, there was at the same time a U.S.-led global population control movement that was happening. So by that time, by the early 1970s, the U.S. government, in collaboration with International Planned Parenthood Federation, had brought birth control methods, some of which were known to be unsafe, to Latin America. And population controllers believed that population control was needed to help spread modern capitalism and prevent the spread of communism, and also to curb growing world population numbers, which they believed posed an existential environmental threat. So early self-helpers who were developing menstrual extraction as a group practice believed that the population control movement was a coercive imperialist project. And this belief led them to develop their positions on everything from international birth control programs to sterilization to abortion, along with what they argued were very key differences between menstrual extraction and what was at the time called menstrual regulation, basically a manual suction abortion technology that was very similar to the one that self-helpers had built, but that International Planned Parenthood Federation had started to bring to South Asia. And so I think it's interesting to kind of think about this anti-imperial politics that really informed the inception of the gynecological and abortion self-help movement. As you were saying, Bay Area Clinic Defense, which was forming in the 1980s around Bay Area Coalition Against Operation Rescue, and then really coming into its own in the 1990s. They changed their name to Bay Area Coalition for Reproductive Rights. They were largely an anti-imperialist coalition. Some Bakor members had been very involved in supporting the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. And some Bakor members were part of a group called Women Against Imperialism, which grew out of Prairie Fire Organizing Committee, which evolved out of the Weather Underground. Some clinic defenders were members of a group that you mentioned called Roots Against War. And Roots Against War was a people of color, anti-imperial, anti-war, and reproductive justice group that initially formed to resist the 1991 Gulf War. And I'll tell you just a little bit about Roots Against War, and I'll also say that really this is a story that the Roots Against War folks will tell themselves when they're ready, and I'm excited for them to do that. But just to briefly kind of introduce the history, In 1990, leading up to the Gulf War, this young group of people of color in the Bay with their different political analyses came together to envision what an anti-imperialist, anti-war movement could look like. What they were seeing was how the government was using conscripting young, poor people of color to fight the war. And they also saw the racism of the mainstream anti-war movement. So this young group of activists decided to call themselves Roots Against War, or RAW for short. And they saw themselves as direct descendants of militant 60s movements like the Black Panthers and the Young Lords and the American Indian Movement. And they thought of their struggle as totally connected to struggles in South Africa and Palestine. And they also saw connections to reproductive rights, you know, the simultaneous erosion of abortion rights and the conscription of women of color, many of whom were Black. They saw the way that Operation Rescue was trying to spread the idea that abortion was Black genocide. And they were not afraid to call out like the opportunism and racism of what Operation Rescue was doing by saying that. And so the story of Roots Against War, I think, really shows the power of intersectional coalitional organizing, or, you know, what at the time activists sometimes called multi-issue organizing, which I'm sure, you know, you recall. And I think that these types of lessons are so important today at a time when people can be really hemmed in by like the popular identity politics that we were talking about earlier and the single issue organizing that this framework can sometimes produce. And I think also that one thing that Bacor really understood was a contradiction at the heart of the Christian right. And this is precisely the contradiction that revealed to Bacor the right's, you know, fascist leanings. The anti-abortion movement has claimed for some time now that, quote, abortion hurts women, and that it, the anti-abortion movement, exists to protect women. But what Bacor exposed was how what the right actually wanted to do was exploit and discard women. And this actual ideology of the right, the idea that women should be, you know, subservient to men, that women are wombs that exist to be exploited, that poor women of color are disposable, these are fascistic or outright fascist ideas. And Bacor wanted to counter this. So I remember a clinic defender in my book named Laura Whitey. She told me about linking arms with fellow clinic defenders in the 90s to hold the line against a mob of white male antis who were basically punching and kicking them. And Laura told me the antis wanted to hit women. They enjoyed hitting women. You know, and Bacor was made up of a lot of queer and gender nonconforming folks. And so they saw also how the anti-abortion campaign was inextricable from the right's anti-gay, anti-LGBTQ agenda. And Bacor wanted to expose this ideology. So they did it by confronting the far right head on, like, again, holding clinic defense lines like Laura did against throngs of antis. You know, sometimes their approach involved staging satirical street theater to, you know, expose the true ideology of the right. And so the way that Bacor fought fascism was by bringing together militant community self-defense tactics in the street with rigorous ideology critique. So in a nutshell, they were bringing together theory and praxis. And that's how they fought the right.
So now we're in a very different moment than we were, I think, when you even started to write this book, or at least to research it. In the introduction, you talk about going to demonstrations during the period when the Dobbs decision was about to be handed down. And you said that you were wearing a T-shirt advertising Plan C. Pretty briefly, because this is something we could totally do a whole show about. What is Plan C?
Oh, definitely. And there is a new Plan C documentary that is now available for streaming. And, you know, folks should check it out to learn the full story. But PlanCpills.org is a website, and it is an American public health education campaign that was started to basically normalize self-managed abortion pills obtained through the mail. So today, that website, PlanCpills.org, is a kind of hub for information about how to obtain abortion pills by mail. At the website, you can learn about different options for obtaining abortion pills by mail, like regardless of the legal status of abortion in your state.
So one thing that I just learned actually from the Plan C website is that abortion pills are now available free in pretty much every state where abortion is banned through the work of community service networks. There's one for just about every state with an abortion ban, and so people are mailing out pills. They're providing doula care for people who are undergoing abortion, self-managing their abortions at home. People are doing like incredible solidarity work to keep abortion accessible as the courts and the legislatures try to make it inaccessible and criminalized. I mean, some of the tools that you describe in your book, from menstrual extraction to clinic defense, were developed at a time when abortion pills were not widely available. And you actually discuss that journey and the fight for abortion pills in the U.S. somewhat extensively in the book, and the work of a woman named Leona Benton and the people that supported her to bring a test case around access to abortion pills. But abortion pills didn't become available in the U.S. until about 2000, and it was made available slowly. But now, well over 50% of the abortions in the country are done through pills, and that percentage is going up all the time since COVID. And my understanding is they've actually learned a lot of things, like COVID sort of demanded that providers learn a lot of things they didn't know about how long abortion pills are effective and safe, and how safe it is to use them without actually being seen by a provider, which it turns out it's safer than anybody imagined. So are the technologies that you discuss at length in the book, like menstrual extraction, still relevant today? Or is the landscape of protecting abortion access now really about disseminating information and support around how to access pills?
That's such a great question. And also, I just appreciated what you were saying about your experience at the Plan C website, you know, and just how options for obtaining abortion pills by mail in banned states have just proliferated. Plan C is just doing such essential work to kind of like track and maintain like the very complex and ever-changing abortion pill infrastructure in the U.S. And I think absolutely we need to keep educating ourselves and educating each other about this infrastructure. We need to keep spreading information and education about abortion with pills. It's so important. And at the same time, abortion pills today are not enough. The wide availability of abortion pills, is not in itself a sufficient abortion infrastructure. And I'll just try to say a few things to help explain why that's the case. I remember having a conversation with Lindsay Comey about abortion pills, and she described the legalization of pills in 2000 that you referenced as just an absolute win for women's safety, because abortion pills allow people to have secrets, right? Like if someone's in a non-supportive or an abusive relationship and they want to terminate, they can simply say that they had a miscarriage. Pills ensure privacy, or they help ensure privacy. And again, abortion pills are widely available by mail. So this is a real lifesaver for people who live in banned states or in abortion care deserts who are early in pregnancy and who want to terminate. But just as there are many reasons why someone might choose to have an abortion with pills, there are also many reasons why someone might choose to or require an abortion in a clinic setting. You know, for example, if your home is not a safe place for you to terminate, or if you're unhoused, then going to a clinic to have a procedure might be the better, safer option. You know, and as Lindsay put it to me, abortion, a surgical abortion remains the bottom line. You know, if there's any retained tissue or even just painful blood clots that someone is not able to tolerate passing from a medication abortion, then aspiration is used to complete the abortion procedure. So that is to say, if someone has an incomplete abortion with pills, which occasionally happens, then they do need to go to a clinic for a procedure to complete the abortion. Later abortion care requires an in-clinic procedure. So you cannot take abortion pills and have a later abortion at home. All of which is to say, we absolutely need to fight to keep clinics open. And we absolutely need to show up for independent abortion clinics, which, you know, in the United States do provide the majority of care, both medication and surgical are provided by independent clinics. I want to circle back to your question about whether menstrual extraction or manual vacuum aspiration is still essential, even during our era of abortion with pills. The short answer is yes. And I think what I want to do is quote a self-helper from my book, whose pseudonym is Max, and who broke it down in this way. She said, basically, first, I'd want to talk with people about the importance of abortion with pills before I talk to them about menstrual extraction. And then she added, but I do think it's important to keep the knowledge of menstrual extraction because it's conceivable that a fascist government could cut off the medication. A lot of people say, no, too many ports, too many places where the medication comes in. But I think it's a real threat. And there are places where people can't get pills. You know, also recently, the New York Times reported that Polish scientists had developed some lab testing that could potentially detect if a person had taken mifepristone or misoprostol, the abortion pills that are used together, in samples of blood or placenta. So, you know, if abortion pills were to become less available, they are quite widely available at this time, but if they were to become less available, we do have simple section abortion. And simple section abortion remains the bottom line.
So in 1 minute, about, what would you say are the couple most important lessons of your book for the struggle for bodily autonomy going forward?
Oh, it's such a big question. And at the end of my book, I do try to synthesize and kind of name some specific lessons of abortion self-help and clinic defense for our present and future struggles. And inevitably, the way that we kind of interpret these lessons will continue to change as the legal landscape continues to change. Today, in 21 states, abortion is banned or severely restricted. And while we know that most Americans don't want laws restricting the decisions they make about their own bodies, including abortion, it is the anti-abortion lobby that has the power right now. I was just looking at a new piece published by ProPublica that talks about how in banned states, attempts by lawmakers to pass exceptions in cases of fetal non-viability or rape or incest, or to save a pregnant person's life. These attempts to pass exceptions have faced serious opposition. The anti-abortion Christian lobby is fighting hard for total bans. And what is happening is that lawmakers are rolling over for them. So when the legal landscape is becoming more and more draconian, not less, what can you do? And I think one of the lessons of radical abortion defense that I do talk about at some length at the end of my book is the importance of making the referral. So we know that a key to safe abortion has historically been the referral to knowledgeable, trustworthy care. This has long been a tool of underground abortion workers. And I think PlanCPills.org shows us what a sophisticated referral program can look like. As laws become more restrictive, it's so crucial for people to be accountable to good information that's out there and to be able to really talk about it with some level of proficiency. Another lesson that I want to kind of underscore that I talk about at the end of my book is the lesson that we need to work with many hands. I learned through my research and my study of this history that, you know, small groups of people who work together in a close, secure, and dynamic way can really make revolutionary change. And it's not easy to work with other people in that way, and it takes patience and practice. But if you can do it successfully, you can really build community power. And for that reason, it's really one of the most important political lessons that there is, I believe. So, you know, what can you do with your hands? How do you work with many hands? Well, certainly you could start your own self-help group like the activists I write about did. But there are other ways to work with many hands. You know, you could organize a demonstration to, for example, expose a fake clinic, what are sometimes called crisis pregnancy centers that try to trick people into believing that they're abortion providers when, in fact, they exist to frighten and shame them away from having abortions. And Kate, I know that you know all about this because you put together an excellent piece of broadcast journalism, a short documentary on fake clinics. So you can work with your hands to make banners and signs and props and art for a political action. There's just so many opportunities to work with your hands and to get together with other people and sort of build your skills and your ability to work with others. I guess finally, I would just say, self-helper in my book, whose pseudonym is Max and who practiced self-help for many, many years, said to me at one point, and this was so powerful, she said to me, I want the readers of your book to know that they can do this wherever they are. And this that she's talking about in this context was menstrual extraction or manual suction abortion. But of course, this is so much more than just menstrual extraction. It's also learning how to do your relationships differently. It's learning how to defend your community from inside of your community. And it's learning how to see and then saying no to the ideology of the right, the ideology of health denial and exclusion and punishment and abandonment that the right has really embraced. And we can do things, Max reminds us, wherever we are.
Angela Hume has been my guest. Her new book is called Deep Care, The Radical Activists Who Provided Abortions, Defied the Law, and Fought to Keep Clinics Open. Angie, thank you so much. This has been amazing.
Thank you so much, Kate. Your questions were amazing. I just really, really appreciate this opportunity to share about the book.
That was Kate Raphael talking to Angela Hume about her very important new book called Deep Care, The Radical Activists Who Provided Abortions, Defied the Law, and Fought to Keep Clinics Open, which you can get through AK Press and elsewhere online.
Keep on moving proudly. Proudly, never turning back, never turning back. Gonna keep on singing loud.
Wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us, oldschoolstyle@feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and via the Stitcher app. Thanks for listening.
The program that you just heard was a rebroadcast. It previously aired here on KPFK.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for your donations and overwhelming support of this listener-sponsored community radio, KPFK. It is the support of listeners like you that keeps this station strong, fiercely independent, and powered by the people. Thank you from all of us at Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM.
Some of them ask me where me get it from. I told them no, no, it's from creation. I told them no, no, it's from creation. Bam, bam, ayo.
Support comes from Art Don't Sleep and Jazz is Dead, presenting the Queen of Reggae, Sister Nancy, on July 21st at the Mayan Theater. There's no wrong time to play Bam Bam, a perfect song, and Sister Nancy is the perfect summer concert. Tickets available at